This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Today we'll look at whether most communities will reject marijuana businesses the way Colorado has.
75 to 80% of the state has opted out of having the business of marijuana in their community. I think Michigan will follow suit.
Then a Bridge Magazine analysis finds schools with low-income students and low achievement are most likely to have uncertified substitute teachers.
It exacerbates the opportunity gap that already exists in Michigan.
Racist comments by a juror during deliberations ends up in a second trial.
We've always known that there's a racial bias in our system, and we want to extinguish that. But when it's hidden, it's much harder.
And a federal case reveals emails about legislative money and votes.
Most of the conversation focused around the implications for political contributions, depending on how Larry Inman would vote.
Plus, we'll talk about legislation to create background checks for private gun sales in Michigan. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The number of long-term substitute teachers in Michigan classrooms increased by 10 times in just 5 years. We'll have the details later in this hour from Bridge Magazine reporter Ron French. But first, Michigan voters might have approved of the recreational use of marijuana, but it appears they're not as keen on the idea of marijuana businesses in their towns. This week, three communities voted to reject proposals for different kinds of marijuana businesses, everything from retail to growing facilities. Joining us now is one of the leading opponents of legalized weed in Michigan, Scott Greenlee with Greenlee Consulting. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
I think the most surprising vote came out of Highland Park. Voters in that city voted more than 2-1 for recreational use of marijuana, but rejected by a fairly wide margin a proposal for marijuana businesses. Why do you think that happened?
You know, I think as people are starting to understand more and more of how the law is written, they're having second thoughts. We had several voters who were quoted in some of the Detroit papers as having voted for the proposal and regretting that vote. And like Colorado, where about 75 to 80% of the state has opted out of having the business of marijuana in their community, I think Michigan will follow suit. And in a few years, you'll see, you know, marijuana businesses available only in some large metropolitan areas.
Yeah, the Detroit Free Press reported that more than 500 communities passed ordinances banning marijuana businesses. But in some of those, voters are working to put the issue on the ballot in the hope that the voters see it differently than the city councils and village boards. What do you expect to come from those efforts?
I think more often than not, the council's decision will be upheld, and we're aware that there are a lot of other communities that are working on opting out, if you will, and taking that move even before voters would consider it. And that's because of pressure that they're getting from their residents. So I expect that number to continue to climb. Certainly there will be some challenges in some communities, but by and large, I think it'll be upheld, and you'll see certainly not the majority of communities wanting this business in their communities.
As a leading opponent of legalized marijuana, what is your strategy during this period of working out whether cities will allow marijuana businesses?
So Healthy and Productive Michigan is now doing strictly education, and of course, policy encouragement. So we're working with municipalities on how they opt out. We're certainly available to provide facts and figures and examples from around the country, Colorado being the one that's had legalized recreational marijuana for the longest amount in the U.S. So we use a lot of the examples there. And certainly we're out and we're speaking when we're requested, which it seems like we get a speaking request every week, and just trying to do everything that we can to encourage everything to be as responsible as possible, and certainly to help those that don't want the business in their community. And that's an important distinction. Because of the voters' vote, people may use marijuana recreationally wherever they want in the state of Michigan, although it's obviously still illegal federally, and Michigan, the last time I checked, is still part of the United States. So some organizations like the University of Michigan and Michigan State and other federally funded organizations came out immediately and said, nowhere, no how on our property, period, end of story. That said, obviously, Michigan voters have decided to disregard federal law, and technically, therefore, in Michigan, I guess, it's legal to use anywhere. This opting out only has to do with the business side of things. So people in those communities should be able to apparently use marijuana recreationally, they just can't buy it within the bounds of those communities.
Well, let's talk about some of those businesses, because some of them are about checking the product to make sure it's safe, that it's processed correctly. How do you think banning those businesses will affect those who want to access marijuana they know is not contaminated by pesticides or something like that?
You know, it's, again, unfortunate that the check and balance type of businesses, because of the way the 6,500-word proposal, that's right, 6,500 words, which a lot of voters didn't realize how detailed and yet ambiguous the entire proposal was if they had read more than just the 100 words that were on the ballot. So it's unfortunate that they've bundled together those type of businesses with the retail stores and things like that. So voters in those communities and many others are simply saying, we don't want anything to do with it. Those communities that are going to choose to sell it from a retail standpoint to grow it, they can have the check and balance type businesses located in those communities as well.
You know,
they essentially want to keep marijuana and everything to do with marijuana as far away from their kids, their schools, their neighborhoods as possible.
You know, some people are looking at this as an important economic development issue. One of the public universities, Lake Superior State University, has launched two cannabis degree programs, one in chemistry, one in business. Why would you continue to fight even when institutions like that are embracing this as a legitimate business opportunity?
Well, it's kind of funny. Again, I default to federal law. You know, I mean, if it's against the law to kill someone federally and Michigan voters say, no, in Michigan, it's going to be okay, I'm probably going to default to a federal situation. And obviously that's a stretch, but years ago you would have thought legalizing marijuana and kind of picking and choosing what federal laws you were going to adhere to would have been a stretch as well. Look, I know that there are these type of economic programs, but when you talk about economics, it's interesting to find out that in the great state of California, who just legalized recreational marijuana in 2018, they actually took in less tax dollars, understand that, they took in less tax dollars that year than they had in 2017 when it was only available medically. Why is that? When there's so much more marijuana available, there's so many more pot shops in every corner. Well, it's very simple. The black market thrives. You know, the economics don't add up. The governor of California stated, and I'm paraphrasing slightly, he said states that are looking to approve recreational marijuana for an economic boom or to improve themselves financially are making a big mistake and shouldn't do it based on that.
Scott Greenlee led the campaign to vote no to legalize marijuana. He's now looking at municipal level bans on marijuana businesses. Thanks for talking with us.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Let's turn now to a spokesman for the Michigan Cannabis Industry Association, Josh Hovey. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Lester.
So we saw voters in these three communities reject proposals for marijuana businesses. What do those votes mean for the industry?
Really not much. The industry, for the most part, is focused on the communities that are welcoming the businesses and the jobs and tax dollars that they bring. And we're convinced that once others see that the sky doesn't fall, that all of the largest concerns that people have about welcoming this industry don't really come true, we believe that more cities and communities across the state will come on board over time.
I wonder how you explain something like Highland Park, for example, when that city voted more than 2-1 for legalizing marijuana, but not for any kind of part of industry.
Well, I think it's really rejecting a ballot initiative approach. When you have a ballot initiative, you don't really get to come up with compromise and have a full open debate. It's really a yes or no decision. And so it's much better for communities to go through a legislative process, hold hearings and gather public input and determine what type of zoning and licensing regulations are best for them rather than to have just an up or down decision.
I guess what I'm wondering is why do you think there seems to be this contradiction voting for recreational marijuana but against the business structure to make it safe and available?
Well, I think there's some communities out there that voted to because they didn't want people being arrested or going through any kind of legal consequences for marijuana use and possession. Some communities might not be ready to welcome a business, but I would encourage them to keep in mind that this is a highly regulated industry. These are very professional organizations that go through a whole lot of vetting at the state, and it's much better for them to welcome these businesses rather than to keep marijuana in the black market.
There are hundreds of city councils, village boards, commissions that have already banned marijuana businesses in their community. Some voters are gathering signatures in some of those towns to get it on the ballot. How common is that? And if what you said earlier about petitions is the case, how successful do you expect that to be?
You know, I think it's going to be a community by decision. And, you know, it's hard to say right now because it all depends on how the initiatives are written at the local level and whether they're written with compromise in mind. There could be some activist groups out there who are far more progressive and far more liberal with their proposals than what the city council might otherwise recommend on its own. And I think that needs to all be taken into mind. And a good ballot initiative will do its own local focus groups and polling and make sure they zero in on what's right for the community. And that's what needs to happen if a ballot initiative is going to be successful.
Are there places where growers, processors, inspection operations are already up and operating or planned for a community that's accepted it?
We have medical marijuana facilities across the state that are already talking with their communities about transitioning into the adult use market. And there are dozens of communities in Michigan that are already working towards approving their adult use ordinances so that they can have both medical and recreational marijuana in their community. And I think that's a smart decision. I mean, the only way for them to benefit from the tax dollars of legalization is to have retail operations in their communities. And that's something that every city needs to keep in mind. If they want to benefit from the tax dollars and the jobs, the only way they do that is through retail.
What is your group, the Michigan Cannabis Industry Association, actually doing to help the industry find places to build the infrastructure it needs?
It's really up to each business owner to find a location that works right for them. What we are doing is serving as a resource. If any elected official wants to gain our opinion and insight into what type of regulation works best for a community and what are some of the best practices, well, we're available and serving as that resource. But we're not actively going out community and lobbying for them to open up their ordinance and to allow these businesses. That's a local decision, and we respect that. From a policy standpoint, we just are able to be a sounding board for best practices and make sure that whatever they're doing is not going to have the unintended consequences of setting the hurdles too high or driving people back into the black market.
Josh Hovey is a spokesman for the Michigan Cannabis Industry Association. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks a lot, Lester.
Coming up, it's rare when a judge vacates a first-degree murder conviction, but that's what a Macomb County Circuit Court judge did this week. We'll have the details in 10 minutes. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Michigan schools are increasingly relying on uncertified long-term substitutes to teach Michigan students. Bridge Magazine released a series of reports on the greater dependence on long-term substitutes in districts scattered around the state. Joining me now is one of the reporters who looked into the issue, Ron French. Hi, Ron.
Pleasure to be here.
I think we all had substitute teachers at one point or another in school, but that was usually only for a few days. You're not talking about that. What do you mean by long-term substitutes?
Absolutely. You know, that's what everyone assumes when they hear a substitute. It's Mrs. Jones is out ill, and so someone comes in for a few days. Usually at that time, it was a retired certified teacher who would come in for a few days and take over the class. No, what a long-term substitute is someone who is by state law is allowed to teach a class for a full year. But they basically have the same requirements as far as education as a short-term substitute. This is someone who can come in and be in charge of your child's classroom, your third grade classroom or your middle school math and science class, who can have as little as 60 college credits, no associate's degree, no bachelor's degree, no background in specific core curriculum.
So how has that been? It's not always been that way, right?
Well, there's always been the opportunity for that to happen. But over the past 5 years, what has happened is that the number of classrooms led by these long-term substitutes, who generally are not certified teachers, has grown tenfold across the state. This struck us as a dangerous sort of trend. You have some school districts and charter schools around the state that have between over 40% of their teachers are long-term substitutes now.
Why are we seeing more long-term substitutes being used in schools?
We did a lot of interviews on this to try to get a sense of why this is happening. And it really is a manifestation of a growing teacher shortage we have in the state. Technically, there are enough teachers out there to fill every teaching slot, but they aren't geographically dispersed. So in urban areas, in rural areas, in school districts that are more challenging, perhaps because they're low income, and particularly in charter schools that tend to pay less, they can't find certified teachers anymore to fill all their slots. And so they need it. I had someone say, you know, we got to have a warm body in front of our class. And so they turn to these long-term substitutes.
Well, why is this growing reliance on long-term substitutes really a problem? If they're in there and they're teaching the kids, does it matter that they're certified?
It's a very good question. And there's actually more than you would think debate about that. But generally speaking, education experts who have done studies on this find that students learn more when they are in classrooms that are led by certified, highly trained teachers. And also, there is some very disturbing data out there that show you that if you are in a classroom with a low qualified teacher 2 years in a row, you never catch up academically.
Give me an example of that. Have you seen that in a particular school?
Well, there are several examples. One, I think many of your listeners may be familiar with news around the Benton Harbor schools here
right.
Recently. I know that the governor is considering shutting down the high school because of just abysmal academic performance. They've had low test scores forever. In fact, they haven't had a student graduate from Benton Harbor High School who is considered by scores to be college ready in the past 6 years. In that school district, 44% of teachers are long-term substitutes. The former superintendent said most of those long-term substitutes do not have any college degree. And the district was on schedule to have more than 60% of their classrooms filled with long-term subs by next year.
Well, you noted that schools with larger low-income populations or schools that are underachieving are more likely to have a greater percentage of long-term substitutes in the schools. Why is that the case?
There are a couple things going on there. If you or I are looking for a job, we're going to go to the place that has the best work conditions and the best pay. And unfortunately, learning, that generally is the suburbs of Michigan. And generally the districts in the suburbs tend to pay more. Why would I go to work in a Detroit charter if I can work in Bloomfield Hills and get paid more? And the working conditions are generally easier. The students generally are achieving at a higher academic level because they have more background at home in education. So it's an easier life for the teacher. No one can blame them. But when there's a teacher shortage, where you're going to see that first are in the schools that have a harder time filling. The problem with that, Lester, is that the students who need the best teachers, those who are struggling academically, who live in low-income school districts, are the ones who are most likely to have the less qualified teachers. And what that does is it exacerbates the opportunity gap that already exists in Michigan.
So how do you solve this teacher shortage problem and the resulting dependence on long-term substitute teachers who are not certified?
People are struggling to find a short-term solution to this. There is a possibility that the legislature could look at putting a cap on the total percentage of long-term subs that can be teaching in a school at one time. There could even be something that looks at least notifying parents when their child is in a classroom that is being led by a long-term sub. Long-term, the only real solution is to increase the number of teachers in the state. And the way you do that, only way you can increase the pipeline is to increase incentives to be a teacher. Teachers overall have lower pay and worse benefits than they did a decade ago. And certainly they are blamed more now than they were in the past. It's not an attractive profession to be in anymore. The state superintendent, Dr. Michael Rice, just told me yesterday that it took us a decade to get into this problem. It's going to take a decade to get us out.
We've been talking with Bridge Magazine reporter Ron French. He and Mike Wilkinson looked into Michigan's greater reliance on uncertified long-term substitute teachers because of a teacher shortage in Michigan. You can find the reports at bridgemi.com. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you.
We saw a news release from a law firm this week. Here's the first sentence. A Macomb County Circuit Court judge today ruled that a Clinton Township man's 2013 first-degree murder convictions must be vacated because a juror made racist statements while he was deliberating guilt or innocence. Here to talk about that is Wade Fink, whose firm issued that release. Welcome to the program.
I appreciate it, Lester. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the conviction. Terry Lamont Wilson was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. What exactly happened to lead to this sentence being vacated?
Well, this was a criminal conviction, like you said, from 2013, and there was an original trial with different lawyers, and essentially the question was whether or not this was murder or whether this was self-defense. The jury in the case in 2013 found Terry guilty of first-degree murder. He was sentenced to life in prison, as is mandatory. Terry had another lawyer, his appellate counsel, do some his appeals as of right, which are typical after a jury conviction, and they were unsuccessful. And Terry and his family found me to do some post-conviction work and asked that I do a federal appeal, which is kind of your last avenue of relief. And in so doing, we did kind of a factual investigation and started interviewing some witnesses. And at the very last minute, really a week before our deadline, I said, you know what, let's give the jurors a call. I had a private investigator give the jurors a call. And lo and behold, we discovered that one of his jurors was overtly and viciously racist.
Well, how do we know that? I mean, it's in the jury room. How do we know that something racist was said?
So my private investigator was able to discover from one of the jurors that when he called her, she said basically that she's been holding this in for a long time, but that there were racist statements made in deliberations. And she shared with us that this man, 40-year-old white male, had said that this guy's a ghetto black guy, this guy being Terry, my client, and this is what ghetto black people do. They kill people. And it started with that statement. We filed a motion in court based on that. We had an evidentiary hearing. And when we got to the hearing, Lester, three other jurors showed up. Well, all the jurors showed up, but three others also remembered pretty horrific racial statements, including the use of the N-word by the same man. So it became pretty evident that something went on in that jury room that was very inappropriate.
So explain the legal process to you. On what grounds do you file a motion to get a sentence vacated because of racist statements by a juror?
So that's what's most interesting about this case. I mean, first of all, Terry's appeals as of right had already been exhausted. So his first round of appeals, which is usually your best shot, had already been exhausted. So he was left pretty much with a federal appeal, or there's one other avenue in Michigan called a 6500 motion, where you can make a motion to vacate a judgment based on something you didn't know about, in a nutshell. And what's interesting is in 2017, the United States Supreme Court decided a case called Peña-Rodriguez, Colorado versus Peña-Rodriguez. And for the first time in our history, a 200-year history, the Supreme Court said there's one exception to the rule that jury verdicts can be questioned, or what happened in a jury room can be questioned. That's called the no impeachment rule. Generally, we say you can't ask jurors what they talked about because we want them to be able to freely share their thoughts with each other and deliberate a case, so we don't inquire into what was said. But the Supreme Court said that there's going to be one exception for that because it holds such a unique stature in our nation's history, and that's going to be race. So this 2017 case comes out, says there's an exception to the no impeachment rule for race. And once we found out these statements were made, we made a motion under the 6500 rule that I mentioned and told the judge, look, the Peña-Rodriguez case allows for jury verdicts to be reversed based on this kind of conduct. And I think, I'm not sure, Lester, but to my knowledge, if not the first, it's certainly one of the first reversals since that Peña-Rodriguez case came down from our United States Supreme Court in 2017.
Now, in your release, you say that this is a reminder that pernicious racial bias still very much exists, but it's not that often we learn what a juror says during the conversations to determine guilt or innocence. Now that you can go find out that through questioning, how do you think this decision will affect future juries?
Well, you know, that's a very, very good question. It's something I've thought about a lot. Because from a policy standpoint and thinking about what is the best way to try to, you know, extinguish racial bias from the system, you know, a lot of times in this case, it's a one in a million type of case, or maybe not one in a million, but it's certainly rare that the racial bias is so overt, right? That somebody would make these statements, use the N-word in front of other people, and then that would come out and that would lead to a reversal of a conviction, because usually racial bias, certainly in 2019, is subvert. It's not as in your face. So I guess I'm concerned that, you know, we've always known, criminal defense lawyers, that there is racial bias in our system, and we want to extinguish that. And I think the law is doing the best job to do that. But when it's hidden, it's much harder, Lester. So we got to be vigilant against these types of biases and try to root them out before anything ever goes to trial. Asking jurors the right question, encouraging other jurors to root out any prejudices and judge cases on their facts. We just got to remain vigilant, because it's not going to be as obvious sometimes as it was in this case.
How likely is it that the Macomb County Prosecutor's Office will appeal this decision?
That, you know, I've had some conversations with them. I don't think they will. I think Judge Fonce is the judge here. She in Macomb County, she rendered an extremely thoughtful 35-page opinion that really went through this whole issue, not only factually, but legally. And I think she did a pretty great job with her opinion. And I don't think the prosecutor's office is an appeal. I don't know that. And I don't want to represent that they aren't, but my gut tells me they're not going to. And I have to say, and I think people should know this, because especially given the atmosphere of prosecutors and police and law enforcement, the Macomb County Prosecutor's Office has handled this with very high integrity, particularly the prosecutor I worked against, Emil Saman, a very high integrity guy that understood this was a serious issue. She did his job, but certainly didn't stand in the way of the right thing being done. I think that should be noted.
So this sentence has been vacated, but Terry Lamont Wilson will be tried again on these charges, pending this any appeal decision by the Macomb County Prosecutor's Office. What happens to Wilson in the meantime? Where is he, and is he still in prison, or will he be released for a while and then go back on trial again? How does this go?
So essentially, it's as if the first trial never happened. So we go back before the trial ever occurred. And it's like any other criminal case, you go from a pretrial status to a trial status. Now, Terry's still charged technically with first-degree murder, and it's very rare in those types of cases that a bond is given. In Judge Fonce's order vacating his conviction, she said there would be no bond, so he's still going to be incarcerated. He'll be transferred from a prison setting, the Michigan Department of Corrections, into the Macomb County Jail to await trial. As opposed to being in prison, he'll now be in a local jail being held before trial. We'll consider whether to make a bond motion. Terry's health is not great, so I don't think he's a danger to the society or a flight risk, and we'll consider those options as this goes on. But the short answer, Lester, is prosecutor has to make a decision on what the charges are going to be. Do they have the witnesses to substantiate the case going forward? And, you know, we'll weigh all options. But if we have to, we'll go through another trial and defend Terry with everything we have.
Wade Fink is an attorney who filed to get a conviction vacated because of racist statements by a juror during deliberations. Thanks for your time.
Appreciate it very much, guys.
A Muskegon police officer was suspended this week after racist memorabilia was found in his home. Here's what's been reported so far. Charles Anderson had his house on the market, and potential buyers came by for a tour. One of those people was Robert Mathis, a black man who says he became uncomfortable when he saw how the house was decorated. Here he is speaking with Wood TV.
It was a full-length Confederate flag, so I'm like, I'm not liking this. There's one plaque on the wall. So I walk over to the wall, and I read the plaque, and it said KKK application. So I was like, I'm done. I say, I want to get out of here right now.
It was an antique Ku Klux Klan document framed and hanging on the wall. Mathis took a picture and posted it to social media. Now the Muskegon officer is suspended. The other wrinkle in this story, that same officer shot and killed a black man in an alley in 2009 after a traffic stop resulted in a foot chase. The officer says he was attacked. The Michigan State Police cleared the officer of any wrongdoing, but the victim's family wanted a federal investigation. This story is still developing. If there are updates, we'll have them next week on Stateside. Still to come, we'll talk about the potential for gun control legislation in our weekly political roundup. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. It's a pattern we've seen before. There are mass shootings. Some legislators call for gun control. Others say guns are not the problem. Instead, we should have increased mental health care. In the end, neither happens in any substantive way. In the wake of mass killings in Dayton, Ohio, El Paso, Texas, and at a California Food Festival, things might be different this time. President Donald Trump called for expanding background checks for gun buyers. Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican majority leader of the U.S. Senate, has indicated he'll allow debate on bipartisan legislation to expand background checks. The bills have already passed the House. In Michigan, similar bills were introduced. None has received a hearing as of yet. Joining us right now are our Friday political commentators to talk about this. Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the Michigan State Senate. Brandon Dillon is a former Democratic legislator and former Michigan Democratic Party chair. So, Ken, how do you think the Republican leadership in the legislature will respond to calls by Democrats and the governor to debate these so-called red flag bills that would expand background checks and bar certain people from gun purchases?
Well, I think given what has happened recently, and as you pointed out, Lester, there's this disheartening pattern over many years. I think there is a possibility and some potential that the legislature would address what they can, which would primarily be these what are called red flag laws, where you know family members or law enforcement agencies can seek a court order temporarily removing firearms from those who are deemed an immediate threat to themselves or others. So I frankly think there is some potential that that kind of law, which is really a state issue, might get some attention here when they come back in the session.
Brandon, every mass shooting brings this contentious topic to the headlines, and each time not much happens. What do you think about this time?
Yeah, I hesitate to say that I think something's going to happen because we've been down this road a number of times before, but I do think when you have Mitch McConnell indicating a willingness to actually consider some legislation at the federal level, and folks in Michigan seeming to have a more thorough discussion about some of the issues that Ken laid out, like the red flag laws, that there is a potential. But, you know, until we actually see some legislation get through and signed by either the president or the governor, I'm not going to hold my breath because we've been down this road before.
Ken, we saw that the Republicans in the Ohio legislature are considering expanding background checks. Are Michigan Republicans more resistant to the idea than their counterparts elsewhere in the nation?
No, I don't think there's anything particularly unique about Michigan or the Michigan legislature or Michigan Republicans. You know, there's kind of three policy issues that could be addressed. One is the red flag law. The other is expanding background checks, and then you could even, the third issue would be a ban on various assault weapons. Now, I think where the state can have the best impact is the red flag laws. I really think background checks probably is best done at the federal level. I do think, Lester, what's somewhat disheartening, though, about this issue, and, you know, I think a lot of us think, okay, really, will any of these have much impact? Because I think there's probably 100 reasons for these mass killings, and everything matters. You know, lax gun laws, mental illness, social alienation, isolation, video games, some of the craziness on the internet. I think there's just kind of a toxic combination of all of these that sometimes just seem to, you know, trigger something. But, you know, legislators, look, you can't solve all of this, but address what you can address.
Brandon, there's always a lot of concern that if you expand background checks, that is the first move to eventually take Second Amendment rights away from gun owners. What do Democrats ultimately want?
Well, first of all, I think that's always been an absurd kind of notion that any attempt to have any sort of reasonable gun safety legislation is somehow going to lead down a slippery slope of confiscating guns from lawful gun owners. That's not going to happen. There is a consensus in society about what we need to do. And frankly, the consensus is at the level of NRA members and moms who want to see more action against gun violence. The vast majority of the public supports background checks. They support limiting the kind of weapons that people could have. And it's time for the legislature to, I think, step up and at least show that we can get something done so that the next time this happens, we're not starting from scratch again.
Brandon Dillon is a former Democratic legislator and former Michigan Democratic Party chair. Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the Michigan State Senate. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Lester.
Thanks, Lester.
The Freedom of Information Act is used to check government, look up documents, check emails, make sure everything in government is on the up and up. The Michigan legislature is exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. That's why some emails between a state representative and a Republican operative are so intriguing. It's a rare glimpse at how business is conducted behind the scenes at the state capitol, and we're only seeing those emails because they are part of a case in federal court. Here to tell us more about this is Detroit News reporter Jonathan Osting. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm good, Lester. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with this court case. Who's being charged and why?
Yeah, so this is State Rep Larry Inman. He's a Traverse City area Republican. He's accused essentially of selling his vote, or attempting to sell his vote anyways, to a union group on a controversial initiative to repeal the state's prevailing wage law. Now, the Republican-led legislature did, in fact, repeal that law last year, and Larry Inman ended up voting to repeal it. But he was on the fence, not just on the fence. He was planning to oppose it. And these text messages that I reported on show essentially a top staffer trying to convince him otherwise throughout the day in the run-up to that vote.
Yeah, this is a guy named Dan Perro. Who is he?
Dan Perro is a longtime Michigan GOP strategist. He really cut his teeth working with Governor John Engler, both on his campaigns and then for him when Engler was governor, in fact. Perro at the time, though, was now serving as chief of staff to then House Speaker Tom Leonard. So this was last year. Tom Leonard was the speaker. Dan Perro was his right-hand man, really the top aide in the House Republican caucus.
So what was Perro telling Representative Inman?
Well, he did reference the policy argument a little bit, but most of the conversation focused around the implications for political contributions, depending on how Larry Inman would vote. He said specifically if Larry Inman voted against this prevailing wage repeal initiative, you will shut down any incentive for big donors to give to you. He said, you know, he told Inman that he was on the edge already with donors because of his previous votes. But he said, if you vote yes on prevailing wage, my friend, you will get a pass on the other votes. Now, Larry Inman did flip his votes later in the day. And in one telling comment after that, Dan Perro then told him, this is going to make my job much easier. It's going to make this a much easier sell to donors as Larry Inman prepared to run for re-election in 2018.
Now, after you reported or during the reporting for this story, you reached out to Perro for a comment. What did he have to say?
He declined comment, as did a lot of people in this story. What we know from these court documents, why these texts were filed, is because these are folks who likely will be called to testify in the criminal federal case as government witnesses, meaning the prosecutors will call them. So prosecutors haven't accused anybody else of any wrongdoing, either Dan Pero or other lawmakers that Larry Inman texted. But as you mentioned, certainly raising some eyebrows about the nature of these communications that we don't often get to see.
Right. Is this email exchange, do you think it's an outlier, or is this how business is conducted among legislators, the strategists, and the people with money?
Well, we don't know, of course. Certainly, we know that, you know, lawmakers do calibrate their votes often based on their district needs, and certainly are often considering re-election when they do that. Now, we don't know how much of a role specifically PAC contributions or large donor contributions, how large of a role they play. But I mean, the suspicion here, and this is Craig Mauger, he's a watchdog with the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. He told me, you know, the suspicion is that these are the types of conversations that often happen. We don't know, even though these are taxpayer-funded lawmakers, taxpayer-funded staffers, we don't have any insight into their communications on a regular or daily basis. It's only in rare court cases like this and some recent lawsuits that we get to see some internal communications and what actually goes on.
You know, you hear from politicians all the time that, you know, my vote's not for sale, or they say that, you know, these people are giving because of my overall, I align, my philosophy aligns with theirs, but that's not what this email exchange showed.
No, I mean, certainly Larry Inman, the indicted state rep, he's accused of selling his vote to a union group that opposes repeal. Pero's trying to convince him otherwise. Certainly he did, you know, make the case that his district is getting more and more Democratic, and that he thought this vote could hurt him with Democrats in his district. So it wasn't just about the money. And that prediction proved true. He had won re-election by 8 percentage points in 2016, but he only won by a single point. Actually less than 1 point over Democrat Dan O'Neill last year. So he was right to, you know, recognize the changing demographics of his district and perhaps, you know, try and represent folks in his district with a vote. But of course, he ended up not doing that anyways after this conversation that primarily focused around money.
We should clarify, Representative Inman has denied that he did anything wrong and he's pleaded not guilty to the charges. Tell me, Jonathan, as a longtime reporter on the Capitol beat, what's the significance of this revelation?
Well, I think, you know, my story framed it as sort of an insight into how significant PAC contributions are, political action committee contributions are. And I think that's a big part of the story here. Certainly, it's shocking to see some of the just, you know, ribald nature of these comments. But really, this points to a larger issue, which is that PAC money does really dominate Lansing. A large number of lawmakers running for office up and down, you know, high ranking, low ranking, well known, not well known. A lot of their campaigns are driven primarily by interest group unions, businesses, business PACs that are contributing huge amounts of money to these candidates. They're also contributing large amounts to leadership PACs. So the top leaders in the state and many other lawmakers as well have their own PAC. So they're essentially pooling PAC contributions into their own PAC and then sending those out and spending them in what they view as key or important races. I reported in this story that the top four legislative leaders in Lansing, Democrats and Republicans in both the House and the Senate, have each already raised more than $100,000 from interest group PACs since the 2018 election alone. So this is large sums of money that are really driving a lot of the elections statewide for the Michigan legislature.
Jonathan Osteen covers state government for the Detroit News. The title, the headline of the article is "An Easy Sell: Inman Texts Point to PAC Dominance in Michigan Politics." Jonathan, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me, Lester.
It's a classic Michigan summer pastime, tubing down a river on a hot day with a cold drink in your hand. But after years of alcohol-fueled floats, the National Forest Service banned booze on three popular northern Michigan rivers. After public outcry, it reversed the ban. Instead, conservation officers have pledged to educate river users and ramp up law enforcement. IPR's Taylor Wisner went out on the water last month to see how that's working.
On a typical quiet summertime afternoon, the Pine River sounds like this. The 50-mile stretch of narrow, winding water is a premier spot for kayakers and canoers. Its sandy cliffs topped with pines also appeal to tourists looking for picturesque northern Michigan views. But there's a third reason why people love this river, and that's because its reputation as a party spot, where people canoe out coolers full of beer and large groups to camp on the riverbanks. Down the river near Low Bridge, a group of people are relaxing and drinking on a sandy bank. A man named Tom, who declined to share his full name because he was intoxicated, says he hasn't seen many issues with alcohol.
Well, maybe one time out of the last 27 years I've been coming.
When asked why he thought the Forest Service would want a ban, he blamed a few bad apples.
You're always going to have somebody that screws it up, right?
Nearby, a group of 20-year-olds are listening to music and tossing a frisbee around.
Oh, come on, it's right there.
Joe Duke from Gregory, which is about 40 miles southeast of Lansing, says his group of eight have been camped out on the pine for days. He says they weren't told by anyone the consequences of drinking too much.
No, actually, it's been pretty much the same as every year. No difference foreseeable, but saw the Forest Service for the first time in a few years.
Duke says the officers told them where they were allowed to park and left. Overall, it's a pretty mild scene. People are just having a good time, no one too drunk. But the Forest Service says that's not always the case. They say at times the drinking has gotten so out of hand, they've had to rescue people, and families complained of indecency. Litter became an issue, too. So the Forest Service and local businesses decided on a plan to educate people on how to be respectful on the water. But the same issues are still there. Forest Service budgets have gone down, so there isn't money to pay for additional recreation officers. And Assistant Ranger John Thompson says when it comes to writing tickets or making arrests, there isn't a ton the Forest Service can do.
As far as bad behavior, you know, that's a tough one for us. If they're impeding passage on the river, there may be state statutes.
Plus, local law enforcement can't be there all the time. Getting to parts of the pine is hard. The river runs through a forest with steep, sandy banks. Leslie Ariemo, who is the forest supervisor for the Huron-Manistee National Forest, says it's a balancing act. She's hoping having more officers around who explain the rules may influence a few individuals.
But when you go down a river and in 2 hours you see, you know, 10, 12 groups of people, 30, they're all feeding off of one another.
Jacob Miltner, the owner of Pine River Paddle Sports Center, is less optimistic. He's been helping his father load canoes into the river since he was a kid. Over time, he says the family has lost business after people had bad experiences on the water.
It's impossible to reach up and grab an F-bomb out of the air before it hits a little kid's ears. It's impossible to you know, the beautiful girl that's paddling down the river with her friends, and there's a group of drunks on the bank, and they throw them some beads and ask them to expose themselves. I can't ever stop that or erase that memory from those girls' brains.
On the other hand, most of the local businesses rely on the groups who like to drink to rent watercrafts and buy beer at nearby stores. So Miltner says the new efforts from the Forest Service aren't going to work.
I think that it will end up in a ban because no matter what, at the end of the day, I still think that alcohol will be abused if it's allowed.
For now, the Forest Service says it is monitoring the waters this summer and will share observations with the community in the fall, at which point they may need to reassess. For Points North, I'm Taylor Wisner.
Voters in Michigan can now cast absentee ballots for any reason. In Tuesday's election, many did just that. We'll talk to Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson about how no-reason absentee ballots could impact voter turnout and what that will mean for already stretched-thin poll workers. That's Monday on Stateside. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are April Van Buren, Laura Weber-Davis, and Joel Danilevitz. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.